Are Vulcans afraid of humans? Why?
Because there is one species you remind us of.
Vulcans.
We had our wars, Admiral, just as humans did. Our planet was devastated, our civilization nearly destroyed. Logic saved us. But it took almost 1,500 years for us to rebuild our world and travel to the stars. You humans did the same in less than a century.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and circling me in the ring,
this is Tyler Orton, wishing you long life and prosperity, Cam.
Okay, well, that's very pleasant of you. This week, we are here to talk about the evolution of the Vulcans.
Yeah, we've done this with aliens like the Ferengi, the Klingons. We've tackled the Dominion. Cam, mm-hmm. I think this might be the last one we do for a little while, because we've pretty much tackled everything under the sun when it comes to the significant species and even the not-so-significant ones. Remember we did an episode on, like, Gorn, all the green aliens, the Orions as well. It's like we did Andorians, Tellarites. This might be kind of the conclusion to this giant
series. I feel like we need a few more installments to get a Trill episode going. We're close, though.
Okay, I can see that, and I do wonder what Discovery has up its sleeve. Yeah. So I think that's actually a very, very perceptive thing for you, and I'm sad that I did not think of that. So there you go. Cam, why don't we kick it off? All the series have some Vulcan revelations going on, but we need to kick it off where I think it really all began. I think the prime one here, Amok Time from the original series. This is where we get Ponfar a-going. Mm-hmm. Spock's got to go home and fight it all out of him because of his own situation involving his fiancée.
Yes.
This is like really... this is, I think, maybe the quintessential alien planet, alien culture thing that Star Trek does, and you're doing it with a very familiar species, but one that you really know mostly from your main character here, which is Spock. But this is your quintessential Spock episode, even though, you know, we've seen Spock and we've had hints about his own culture throughout the first season, but this is the kickoff to season two.
Well, totally. Like, season one, you get a lot of teases, you know, things like the Vulcan nerve pinch, mind melds, you know, in, like, Dagger of the Mind. So, like, they really do a good job through season one, and I don't know how how intentionally, just building all this mystique around the Vulcans, where you're really like, is this, you know, isolated to Spock? How much does this represent the greater culture? And then, boom, you get the season two premiere, Amok Time, where it's so much grander than you would have ever hoped, especially for, like, 1960s TV.
Well, I think grand is, like, the operative word here. Mm-hmm. And even if you think about, you know, say, the costume design, the weaponry, and you're really getting into that Vulcan aggression that they've been repressing, I think this is, you really get to their core as a culture here.
And why throwing soup.
Yes. But, you know, because we better understand why the Vulcans are so adamant about repressing their emotions, or I should say controlling their emotions, you know, and abiding by this philosophy of logic. And if you can see that they are capable of such violence under these sorts of physiological distresses, you're like, oh, okay, I start to get the species in a way that I never did before.
Yeah, and I love that they take a lot of elements that could be campy, but they play it incredibly straight and in a way that actually gives it a certain grandeur. Like, this does not feel like a species that's being presented as, well, this is kind of silly, right, guys? Like, they do take it very seriously.
Yeah.
And again, it's life and death stakes. You know, it's obviously pitting Kirk against Spock, but you've also got this Spock marriage stuff that really does have huge stakes for the character. And you get it presided over by this character, T'Pau, who, to me, is, like, one of the best parts of this episode, in that, again, it's a character that could easily be silly. Like, look at this woman in this ridiculous getup. But that character has so much gravitas, and you completely buy into this whole ceremony she's presiding over, and it just does so much world-building in, like, no real work. Like, it's not like they are showing us grand, sweeping shots of Vulcan and going into the history of the people. It's like this actress a great set and some, you know, really good writing around it really does create an entire world just out of a mock time.
I will give some props to the crew that did the Blu-ray remaster, though, because they do have some just gorgeous shots of Vulcan, for, like, kind of the exteriors, not just, like, a planetary exterior, but, yeah, like, out in the desert where they're going to be having this battle going on here. To me, this is, like, the quintessential TOS sort of Vulcan episode, but there's some other examples. Maybe we can do a quick lightning round with regards to some other very important Vulcan ones. And I think Balance of Terror is up there, though.
Because I think that's very important. Yeah.
They do establish that, you know, cousins of the Romulans, and there's kind of hints that, you know, these are kind of opposite sides of the same sort of coin. And I think that's a very fascinating sort of journey that we will be taking with the Vulcans and the Romulans for the next 50 years as well.
It's so much fun to look at it in retrospect because it's just this offhand thing of like, Spock, they're just like you. Well, yes, yes, we're related apparently. And little did they probably realize in 1966, 67, whatever that was, that this would like spawn decades of fiction being spun off of this episode.
Yeah.
And of course, Mark Leonard appearing there as well and showing up as Sarek in Journey to Babel.
Another very important one.
Yeah, for establishing the character of Sarek, who I think a lot of people, when you say name what you consider the primary Vulcan of Star Trek, people are going to say Spock. And I think for me, it's Sarek. Because Spock, you have that half-human side, which is interesting just from a Vulcan culture point of view alone. But Sarek is the one that represents Vulcan to me in a way that Spock does not. Spock is a little bit of that rebellious side.
Yeah, you know, it is funny. Like, I think a lot of people kind of associate Spock's personality with what we see in the film series, which is very different than what we see in the... Well, not very different, but there are some stark distinctions that we see in the TV series where we do see that emotional side of him come out far more often. And we do see that, you know, one, Sarek stands in contrast to that.
Yes. And Sarek is that serious Vulcan who really does stand for more of the traditions of his people in a way that original series Spock doesn't. You get more of that in the movies. But, you know, throughout the original series, Spock is a little more torn between the two sides.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting when you see a Vulcan like Sarek come into the show and you go, oh, like, this is really what the Vulcans are like.
And so we've covered kind of the introduction of Ponfar. I think the other thing that you briefly alluded to, though, were the kind of mind melds as well.
Yeah.
And it seems as if after they're introduced through the Horta episode...
Actually, it's Dagger of the Mind first introduces them, and then Horta brings... Horta is the best usage.
Okay.
Like, people will often reference that one because that's the one that actually really matters, you know, in a way that people actually care about.
Yeah.
But it is in Dagger of the Mind.
Okay. Yeah. But it is funny because, like, after that, it's like every fourth episode, we're going to do a mind meld.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it becomes so quintessential to kind of the Vulcan identity from there on out.
Totally. Another element of Vulcan identity that is interesting that shows up in the original series is in the episode Savage Curtain, where we are introduced to the character of Surok, who, of course, is the philosopher that the Vulcans follow, which it's funny that it shows up in that episode. It's kind of a goofy episode. That's the Abraham Lincoln one, for those that don't remember the episode titles. But it, again, is planting seeds for something that is going to be very much explored in the future of Star Trek. There's also another interesting just element. I think we just have to acknowledge the whole Spock's brain issue, where Vulcan anatomy is fascinating in the original series. They are always introducing things like, well, good thing that, you know, this organ is there or what have you.
The Vulcan heart is where the human liver is, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's so many episodes like, well, Spock's not susceptible to this.
Yeah.
So that we learn that apparently they can be driven without brains. It's a fascinating fact of the Vulcan race.
I've seen evidence of you doing that, so there you go.
Every week.
Yeah. So why don't we jump over to the movies, because I think this is very important here. We in the motion picture, we have Spock performing the Kolinar, which is purging all remaining emotions from him. And I think we do have a very different Spock, certainly in the motion picture. And, how do you come down on movie Spock versus TOS Spock?
It's really interesting to me because I was brought into the Star Trek world more so through the movies than the shows.
Same here.
Yeah, and so I was much more familiar with movie Spock. And so it was very strange when I went and watched the original series, which was the first one I went through completely. And it was like, oh, like Spock is really fun. Like Spock was really fun in, like, say, Voyage Home. But he was not a character who I thought of as being a really, like, often funny character, which is what you get in the original series. And him in the motion picture is really fascinating to me. I would love to know what fans thought in 1979. They're going to see Star Trek on the big screen, and you get this Spock purged of all emotion, and he's not really the fun Spock that they're used to.
He's not a fun character in this movie.
He is not at all.
Jump forward to The Wrath of Khan, and I guess it's really the search for Spock that explains the transfer of the Katra over to McCoy.
But we get the introduction sort of the Katra at the end of Wrath of Khan.
I don't think they actually use the term Katra in Wrath of Khan, though, but it is kind of, as you say, the first hints that it's there, and then we get it going in earnest in the search for Spock.
And it's funny because it just seems like it was a very opportunistic device of like, let's just like throw in some breadcrumbs in case we want to bring Spock back. Yeah. I would be very curious how much like thought really went into this foundation of what will prove to be very important to the Vulcan race.
But I think it's so quintessential Star Trek in that like there's some throwaway line or some little tidbit and they jump all over it and make it into a much bigger deal than we would have originally thought. And we get that with the search for Spock, and it's kind of a journey of getting McCoy all better again. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, just that moment at the very end of it where his Katra is transferred back and he's recognizing his friends again.
Yeah.
You dig that line where he's just saying, Jim, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's so great.
Yeah.
How do you think people felt, non-Star Trek fans, sitting in the theater watching Star Trek 3 and having this fairly prolonged Vulcan ceremony at the end of their Star Trek movie?
I mean, that is the way you do a climax in classic cinema, so.
Do you think that would work nowadays? Like, do you think that any film would go with that? Any sort of franchise movie?
But they just don't make movies like it anymore.
No, so, they don't.
No, I don't think any, like, who would be the one putting, you know, that kind of budget into it? Because it's not like, this would not be a $200 million tentpole movie like back in the day. But that's the thing, that they only make nowadays either these tentpole movies or else like low budget $5 million movies. There's none of that in between. When Search for Spock's budget was probably what, like $10 million or something?
Probably somewhere in that area. Yeah, like so that would be the equivalent. Paramount was known to cut the budgets on them all the time.
And this would be the equivalent of maybe a $35-40 million movie.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make $40 million movies anymore. Like, it's just something that's been cut out. So I don't think they would have as much leeway to get away with that.
What was your thoughts on that whole sequence the first time you saw it?
I was kind of bored, honestly.
I don't think it works as well as in a mock time. Like, you can appreciate the pageantry of it all and that they're, again, taking it seriously. They're presenting a Vulcan culture as a culture. They're being respectful towards their creation. But it feels like it's drawn out in a way where you don't get get brought into sort of the fun of it. You're more of a passive observer waiting for the inevitable.
Yeah.
There's no mystery. Whereas in a mock time, you don't quite know how this, this whole thing is going to turn out. We all know Spock's coming back. So you're basically waiting for the chanting to end.
Yeah. Fair enough. Just very briefly, though, the introduction of Cybok. I don't think it's quintessential to understanding Vulcans, and that's what we really want to do is try to better understand Vulcan culture. But I think what we are seeing here is kind of the first introduction of a nonconformist Vulcan, and I think we do see elements of that as that continues on to be a thread in Star Trek moving forward.
Big time. And that was something that initially my thoughts were, well, we can pretty much skip over Final Frontier, but then it was like, after doing the research, you're like, that really was kind of the first Vulcan we saw who really did embrace emotions, and that was an element of what made him, kind of a little bit dangerous, or at least outside the norm of Vulcan society, and could there be more like this?
And you can understand maybe why Vulcans would clamp down on those elements that they would see as just pure chaos, though. And I think it raises good questions about conformity within Vulcan society. There's kind of a very monolithic sort of society going on here, at least as it's portrayed. And I think they do touch on that quite a bit, especially a bit of a spoiler for the end of the episode, but we'll get into that in Enterprise for sure.
Totally. I think the Vulcans are really interesting in that they come across as being very composed, and I think most viewers and fans look at them that way and have maybe a heightened level of respect for the Vulcans over some of the other alien species on Star Trek, and probably even the humans. But the Vulcans are kind of a mess in a lot of ways, and they have all these cracks in the foundation that are always threatening to spill through. And it was really interesting doing the research for this episode and kind of going and tracing it linearly, like through the timeline of Star Trek, and being like, wow, these cracks have just continued to like grow and grow and grow through a lot of the series.
Yeah. For me, maybe I think the next big Vulcan adventure, it's actually a little while later, though. I think, and correct me if maybe you have one in between, but I think maybe Sarek is the next big Vulcan showcase.
Well, I'm glad you said Sarek. The only thing I would mention is that, like, Sarek does play a very prominent role throughout some of the films.
I was talking about the TNG episode.
Oh, I know you were talking about the episode TNG, but he does play, you know, a significant role in the films, and so it's interesting to see that element of Vulcan society being brought through the world of the films, so... We can jump on over to that episode.
Yeah, though. And I think what it's tackling, though, is Vulcan's dealing with old age.
Yeah.
He's 202 years old at this point. Like, that is old. And there's a wonderful line in this, and I know we want to focus on Vulcan culture here, but when Picard just is on the bridge and he points to the consoles, he's like, all of this technology, and yet we still succumb to the mysteries of the mind. And, you know, but it's such a great showcase for, I think Patrick Stewart rightfully gets a lot of credit for his performance, especially at the end of this one.
It's a very brave performance.
But Mark Leonard is really doing this well. Like, there's this vulnerability in there. There's also
Sarek is always sick, though.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
he's never well on an episode of Star Trek until we get to the Star Trek Discovery. I guess well the animated series as well, but
all right. Well, I guess with Leafy, he's not doing well in that one either.
Nope.
But yeah, with this one, like I just think that this is kind of very revelatory about like even like his cadre of helpers there.
Yeah.
His human chief of staff, which I think is very. At first, I was like, well. You know, that's just kind of cool to see that element there. But then you realize it's actually like a story element in that why you need to have like one human and one Vulcan character to make the actual plot happen. It actually makes sense that way. But I think it is revelatory that the Vulcans are at a point where, yes, they would allow like a human to be like his chief of staff because they've come to trust the humans, unlike the way that we see them in on display in Enterprise, which is going to come a couple years later. But still, you do pick up a lot of the cool cultural stuff still within this.
Do you notice much of a difference in the representation of Vulcans in TNG era than in the original series era?
Well, they're not well represented in TNG, which is interesting, you know. And when they are, I think we get more of the movie era Vulcans, like kind of the stiff sort of dudes.
Right. It's almost like they often were written as how maybe an average fan might describe them.
Yeah.
Or something
kind
like
that. Kind of fan-fictiony to a certain degree.
Yeah. It's kind of like a copy of a copy, and sometimes you lose a little bit of the personality that existed. Like, when I watch the original series characters, you know, even like Spock's, you know, bride-to-be in Amok Time, Arlene Martell's character, or even Staun, like, they do have a lot of personality.
Yeah.
And it feels like when you get into the Berman era, they write them more like Spock in, say, the motion picture.
How much do you think that was kind of a Gene Roddenberry mandate, though? Because
it wouldn't surprise me, yeah.
Roddenberry is the one, you know, guiding the motion picture at the time, and then he's the one that, you know, Berman is trying to realize Roddenberry's vision, and maybe that's how Roddenberry now envisioned Vulcans there.
It wouldn't surprise me, because you look at how he viewed humanity by the time of TNG, again, no conflict among the crew, right?
And also, you could argue that they're stiffer than they were in the TOS era. The humans were stiffer.
So if the humans are stiffer...
Yeah. I know.
Those Vulcans.
The other thing is, maybe talking about, like, Sarek from a cultural level, where we're introduced to his new wife, Perrin.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, he's, you know, ambassador to Earth. He keeps marrying Earth women.
Yeah.
You know, fine. But there is something very important here where we have Picard taking on all of these emotions from Sarek.
Right.
And we get the revelation, you know, Amanda, Spock. I love you.
No Cybok.
Sorry, no Michael Burnham. Burn. But, you know, like, you do really, because, Cam, you know, we've had so many discussions about how Amanda must just be going through hell being in this household, you know, with these two men that just cannot give her the kind of what she would obviously want emotionally.
Maybe Spock could have when he was really young.
Yeah,
maybe,
and we get hints of that in Discovery.
Yes.
You know, but with this, it's like, oh yes, Vulcans can love, though. It's about controlling those emotions, though. And like, there's a deep, deep affection And he even acknowledges that it is love for her, but it's he also acknowledges that he couldn't show it. And
right.
I think this is very important about Vulcan society, because you are acknowledging that it's not that they have no emotions. It's that they want to have complete control of emotions at all time.
I think it's a good moment, though, that, frankly, Amanda never got in a pre-Discovery show, where Picard goes to Perrin and says, he really did love you. And she's like, I know. And so you get the acknowledgement that, like, it was this poor woman, like, married to this cold man who's giving nothing. She's able to read him on his level. And I think that means a lot. It makes me feel better about the Vulcan-human relations.
Sure.
All around. Just a side, little minor tangent, though. I just had a question for you in that episode. You have that Patrick Stewart showcase where he's going through, he's experiencing all of Sarek's pent-up emotions. Why is Troy not the one talking him through this?
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good question.
She is a counselor.
Yeah. She really only had, like, one scene of significance there. She's trying to figure out, like, why everybody's punching each other and there's, like, bar fights breaking out.
She does spot Sarek crying, too, or at least turns her head and acknowledges.
Yeah, well, she feels it in the room, so it's not as if she's, like, totally put on ice throughout the episode. But I don't know, maybe Sarek would only trust Picard with that. Maybe one emotionally vacant man to another could do the trick here.
One of the elements of this episode I really appreciated, though, was that we just touched on it. It was Sarek crying during the music recital. And that's something that I think has been really interesting in the original series as well, is that Vulcans have this very austere, you know, face, you know, this facade almost they put forward. But when you see that emotion, it's not good. Like, something is going to happen. There used to be a joke I've heard that, you know, whenever Spock smiles, you're in trouble. And in this case, it's the tear. It's such a small, small thing, but it speaks so much to a Star Trek fan who's watching the show. And I just think it's a really powerful element of that species, that the slightest bit of emotion, the viewer has been taught to pick up on it and recognize that this is a problem.
Well, and the other thing is, like, listening to music is an emotional experience. So it touches people in ways. You listen to one genre over another for a variety of reasons, and, you know,
I listen to Nickelback. I just cry like crazy.
I know you do. I've seen you do it, you know. I kept telling you that cannot be our closeout music every single week. No, Cam. But with this, though, it is fascinating that was it Mozart or Bach that they're performing? I forget which.
I think it was Mozart.
But, like, because it had been established that, Sarek appreciates Mozart.
Sure.
Like, he has an affection for this. Music does have an emotional response for people. And so it is interesting. Kind of, there are these, like, little holes you can poke in this whole Vulcan logic thing. And they do have emotions. Like, that's what I was kind of discovering more and more. It's just about how well or how much they want to control them any given moment.
And also, music has a very, like, mathematical component to it, which also explains why Vulcans would be drawn to it as well, especially when you're playing, like, the classical musics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they appreciate the music of Tool?
It depends on the Vulcan, you know? Maybe the percussion elements.
Sure.
They could go with that, you know? I think you're trying to set up our next closeout music for the episode.
Well, maybe we'll see that on Star Trek Discovery. They've been bringing popular music in more and more.
Yeah. Well, I like the whole Taylor Swift versus Tool debate that was going on a couple weeks back.
Sure.
But, so anyway, maybe the next big one to tackle here, though, would be unification. Because, of course, we have Spock coming back into the television series, and it's about, again, that thread that was established way back in Balance of Terror.
You have to admire the restraint of keeping him on, like, Spock on ice until, like, season 4.
25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really crazy.
And so, but this is really kind of an important cultural element, because, like, there is kind of, like, this belief that eventually these two, you know, related species would be united once again. They diverged, you know, thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating, because I think, you know, just prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall, there were, like, everybody had discussed, like, what happens, like, would Germany ever be united again? Because, like, before the Berlin Wall fell, nobody thought, like, the Berlin Wall was going to fall. Like, it took the world by surprise, you know? And so at the time, you know, people were thinking, like, well, maybe in 100 years it could happen. You know, nobody was expecting it to happen within 1 year.
Right.
So I do wonder, you know, if you hear about a Vulcan and Romulan unification, I mean, would you, in the moment, expect that to happen anytime soon? What Spock is endeavoring to do, or is he just planting the seeds here, Cam?
No, I wouldn't. And that has a lot to do with Romulan representations on TNG, and that it doesn't feel like they're presented in a way where they would mesh with the Vulcans quickly. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like it's going to take a long time, a lot of diplomacy. And even then, I think it would always be unstable.
Well, and because who is bending to whom?
Right.
Is it the Vulcans being more flexible with their acceptance of aggression?
Yeah.
Or is it the Romulans conforming more to logic and repression?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I'm not sure, but I think by Star Trek Picard, maybe there will be another element that's will be bubbling to the surface once again.
Well, I feel like those are breadcrumbs you have to revisit.
Yeah.
But, you know, in this episode, we see that this is like Spock's, it seems like, his goal going to be for the foreseeable future of the character. And we never really get it paid off. We get the whole Sela plot tied in there, and it kind of muddies it up. But is it unsatisfying to wrap up TNG with this just still lingering?
Well,
because it feels so important.
And also think about the Troy episode, Face of the Enemy.
Yeah.
There's another reference to it with you know, cowboy diplomacy. You feel as if they were supposed to continue that on, and they just kind of left it hanging there.
Is it something they should have worked into season 7?
I think so.
Yeah.
At least give it some sort of closure.
Yes. Whether they resolve the two of them together or they just decide this doesn't work, either way, I feel like they should have had some sort of final stamp before they move into the movie stuff. And yeah, you got Shinzon, of course, and Nemesis.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I I don't know. They're giving everybody goodbye episodes in season 7. They could have given one to Sela too,
and Argyle.
Yeah, Argyle. Yes. I guess the last touch of it that we did get though would have been in Star Trek, the 2009 film, though, when it's who's the one who goes to help save Romulus? It's Spock, and he fails at that. So ultimately, as far as Spock knows, his mission was not a success because he's flung back in time and he dies by the time, you know, Star Trek Beyond happens. Mm-hmm. And so it's like he never was able to realize what was going to be, you know, his final goal in life,
right,
as an ambassador, as a diplomat, which is, I mean, I guess it's fitting for a character like Spock, though. It does kind of make sense for his own character arc.
I mean, Spock has had so many successes in his life. Isn't it just an embarrassment of riches if he just gets one more?
Yeah, fair enough. I say the same thing every day about myself. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Not really.
I know you do. You say it nonstop. We have to cut them all out of the podcast.
One little one here in TNG that I'll bring up as well is Gambit, though.
I was going to bring that one up.
Yeah, just because we do have that that kind of Vulcan, again, another Vulcan nonconformist here,
yes,
where they're retrieving that Vulcan artifact. It's essentially like kind of a weapon, but the weapon's only useful when people have aggressive thoughts, and that's
right,
why the Vulcans kind of thought is a useless weapon after a couple thousand years, because they had already become in control of their emotions there.
Yeah, yeah. And I like that they are these isolationist Vulcans who don't like the pollution of the Vulcan race. This kind of ties back to the whole theme of why Spock was kind of a controversial character. And we saw those flashbacks and, you know, the various, you know, kind of references to Spock having a very, you know, rough childhood. And again, you can kind of buy that, again, the cracks in the Vulcan facade, that there would be these groups that would emerge and be like, we are like pure Vulcan.
Yeah.
And they're such a messed up race. Like, it's so funny because we all look at them, I think, with more respect than any other Star Trek alien race.
Yeah.
Don't you feel like that?
For sure, yes.
But they seem just like to have so many, like, the Klingons own who they are.
Well, I was going
to
say that.
Right?
They wear it on their sleeve.
Yes. And the Romulans do, too.
And humans, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the Vulcans don't, really. They always put forward the face of, like, this impenetrable, like, you should aspire to us.
Yes.
And they are the ones with all these like factions splitting off, and it's like they're just barely holding themselves together.
I think there's so much more room to poke holes into this culture.
Oh yeah.
So it's going to be fun if we end up with like a Vulcan lead character in one of the 14 spinoffs that CBS is going to commission, and we're in the 25th century with the Vulcans, and
yeah,
that really. I'd love to explore the Vulcans where they stand in the 25th century as well.
Yeah, me too.
So, Deep Space Nine, Cam, not a whole lot of exploration of Vulcan culture.
No.
I guess the biggest presence we have is Take Me Out to the Holosuite.
Yeah, or Field of Fire with the Vulcan sniper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily as if those ones reveal much about Vulcan culture. Maybe Field of Fire and that, like, yes, Vulcans are susceptible to PTSD as well.
Right.
I'd just say it's kind of an insensitive showcase about how it deals with PTSD. You see an episode like Under a Paper Moon.
Right.
And it's such a great way to really cut into what a difficult situation that is.
Yeah.
And then you see Field of Fire, and you're like, I don't know if this is the best way to do it. At least they are trying to, but what they are trying to say is, like, Vulcans are still susceptible to deep, deep trauma.
Yeah.
And if it's a repressive, emotionally repressive species, and all they can do is act out with violence when their psyches are just torn apart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I guess I can see what they're going for there.
Totally. I mean, I think the issue is, you know, It's Only a Paper Moon is very much a character study and about someone going through this process, whereas Field of Fire is a little more of like a crime procedural on Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's very much, you know, Ezri Dax trying to solve a crime. And so you don't get that sort of the layers that probably nowadays they would be more compelled to add to a character like that who's going through PTSD, you know, a term that's never, I don't think, used in that episode.
No. And But the thing is, like, was PTSD even really a term that they used back in, like, the late 90s?
I don't think so. I mean, you would hear shell shock. I don't think you ever heard PTSD.
I remember in school, I in the 90s, I think they were still using the term shell shock, you know, back then. I don't think it was until, like, post Iraq War that I started hearing, like, PTSD, you know, frequently. So, also, this is not to crap on Field of Fire. I still think the sequence of, like, Ezri using that weapon, like, and the scope on it, I still think, you know, for a series or a franchise that we often complain that it's not the most visually dynamic.
Yeah.
Props to that episode for doing something pretty cool there.
But take me out to the holosuite, though. Getting to that one. You know, maybe it doesn't add much of anything to our knowledge of the Vulcan species and their evolution, but it is fascinating to think of them as really competitive baseball players, because that's not something you think of as Vulcans caring about, like sports. Doesn't that seem trivial to a Vulcan? Apparently not.
I just think that what it does establish is there are just jerks in every society, and the Vulcan captain, he was just a jerk. Like, he knew that he could poke Benjamin Sisko, and he was just trying to do everything he could do to provoke him, and to good effect. You know, it worked on Ben. Ben was able to turn the tables on him, and by the end of it, he was just poking at him with, like, is that a hint of hostility that I detect there? You know, and you could tell the Vulcan was legit annoyed.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that did kind of bother me, they said that it was an all Vulcan crew.
Yeah.
In my head, like, I don't like that idea where there's an entire starship of nothing but one species.
Right.
I can totally, but the thing is, you look at representation of non-humans on Star Trek, and it's very often, like, a very human-centric ship. In my head, in my own, like, fan canon, I've had to justify it as, like, maybe, like, an all-Vulcan senior crew. I think that's what I'd like to believe what it was. And
because that would be a very large complement of Vulcans on one ship.
How do you think that ship functions as, like, an all-Vulcan ship?
Like clockwork.
Yeah.
Spick and span at all times.
What if you were the one and only human on that ship, Cam? How long before you ask for a transfer?
Ooh. Yeah, that would be pretty bad.
Are you just hanging out in the holodeck as long as you can? Like,
I feel like you would spend a lot of time reading books by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well,
and I feel like their entertainment would be brutal.
It'd be meditating.
Yes. Like, there's no, like, music recitals or plays being put on.
No. No more Shakespeare reenactments.
No.
So, okay. Star Trek Voyager.
Oh, I just had one final thing with DS9. Yeah. Does it bother you at all that we never really got to see, like, a well-developed, positive Vulcan character on DS9? Like, they were involved in the Dominion War and all that. We always heard they were around and exploring the Gamma Quadrant. But the most, like, kind of fleshed out showcase Vulcan characters on DS9 are, like, the baseball dude and, like, the Field of Fire guy.
Yeah, and I can't even think of, like, a notable, like, one-off sort of character other than
those
two.
I'm sure
there
was one in a room at some point.
Yeah.
You know, like an admiral or something.
I'm sure
there's,
like, an admiral. Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, I am disappointed because I think the Deep Space Nine was always good at introducing layers to a lot of species there. Like, think about what they did with, you know, say the Vorta over, you know, five seasons.
Yeah.
I think maybe they just wanted to you know, pave their own right. like roads there, so to speak. Or
I wonder if also just they felt the other shows had kind of over-Vulcaned.
Yeah.
And they were like, we just want to be our own Star Trek series, which is why you get that focus on, you know, the changelings, Trills, like species we don't spend a lot of time with.
And so. Maybe if they weren't inspired by a great Vulcan idea within the writer's room, why try to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So, Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah.
For a series featuring a Vulcan lead character,
yeah.
there wasn't that much exploration of Vulcan society so much, or Vulcan culture, which is understandable in that Tuvok is isolated from the rest of Vulcan culture, though, save for, I think they established there's him, Vorik, and I think there's at least maybe one or two other Vulcans. I think they stated that in one episode.
Yeah, so, I believe that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. I don't know, like, I don't know, Blood Fever, Cam? We find out that, I guess, Ponfar can be telepathically transferred onto other people.
Sure,
with
yeah.
With Polana there.
And then we get actual Ponfar in body and soul.
But the thing is, like, yeah. how is that resolved? It's, Tuvok goes into the holodeck?
Yes, he does. Has a date with the wife. Yes, the photon version of his wife. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like that because it's not the same.
Right. You
know, like a holographic program is not the same. And Tuvok knows it's not the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. And wouldn't that resolve so many issues on so many other starships with Vulcan crew members?
One would think.
Yeah.
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 But, like, the Blood Fever one, I guess, is the most interesting in terms of the evolution of the Vulcans, and that, I mean, maybe it's not that much of an evolution, because in the episode of Sarek from TNG, Sarek's, you know, mental illness is being spread to members of the crew telepathically,
sure. yeah.
so the idea of Ponfar being transferred isn't, like, a huge leap as well, that, you know, B'Elanna Torres has it, you know, affect her. But I guess it is just a little bit of an extra addition. Although, and we should say, we have an episode on Ponfar. I'm going to post a link in the show notes, which is why we're not going in-depth on Ponfar in this
yeah.
episode.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Are there any other, like, big Vulcan moments or, like, things that, not Tuvok-centric, but things that are revealed about Vulcan culture throughout the course of Voyager? Like, nothing's really jumping out to me. It's weird that we kind of complain about Deep Space Nine, but I think I've got, like, more prominent examples from Deep Space Nine than I do from Voyager.
Well, there's that puzzle game Tuvok likes playing.
Yeah.
And, that's something Vulcans might enjoy.
Yeah.
So that's something,
there you go.
A little bit of an extra little, you know, bit okay. of fun there for Vulcan fans, I guess.
I'll just say this. We watched Caretaker semi-recently.
Yeah.
And I thought that they set up Tuvok to be just like this great sort of counselor to Janeway.
Yeah.
And I think there was so much room for them to do some cool things with Tuvok, and they just never seized on that. And I was disappointed because based on Caretaker, I think that Tim Russ could have brought it, and he just didn't get that chance, really.
Do you think they felt kind of wedged in because Tuvok is separated from Vulcan society, so they don't want to make any major changes to things going on with Vulcans because obviously Tuvok is completely disconnected, so it's very like, what do? You basically have his biological processes, which, you know, have been pretty well explored in other Star Trek shows, or just the traditions. And, you know, they can introduce, like, a new tradition here or there, but, you know, he references, like, the Taloth, which is, like, something he went through as a young man, which is a variation on something that young Spock went through in yesteryear. But other than that, it's like you almost don't want to create a lot new because is this going to be carried forward in the future? Because you can't explore it when you only really have one Vulcan character on your show.
And
no Vulcan presence forthcoming.
Yeah. I mean, from a cultural perspective, no big revelations from Voyager. But
no, I think they could have done something really interesting when he was paired with Kes, going through her psychic processes. Like, I think they could have maybe found a new angle on, like, the mind meld and maybe some property it might contain, but they never went there.
But, you know, let's jump over to Enterprise, though, because you do, once again, have a Vulcan lead character. And I don't think any series has done more to flesh out Vulcan society than Enterprise. I say that more than TOS, more than TNG, etc., more than the films as well. Like, Enterprise really digs deep into Vulcan society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is, like, props to them. Like, I really appreciate what they do here. Maybe the biggest example, well, let's start with Broken Bow. If only that it's establishing that these are kind of more like parental figures.
Yeah.
And they don't have any trust in their little children known as the humans.
And like all teenagers, the parents are really annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is our jumping off point with Vulcans in the 22nd century. I think that's an interesting thing, although at the time, I just found the Vulcans really annoying. Like they are annoying though. They just seemed like jerks,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And you can understand why Archer wasn't a big fan of them at the time.
Well, when we meet like Sovaal in A Broken Bow, he's not a likable character.
Not at
he's
all.
Not someone you want to spend time with.
But we've got a great journey ahead with Sovaal, and I think it's actually reflective of where they're taking the Vulcan culture throughout these next 4 years here, though.
I do wonder though how many people like Sovaal lost in the first couple seasons, because it takes a long time before Sovaal becomes a character that we have some empathy for and actually understand his journey. It's kind of like, for, at least for, you know, the first two seasons, that character that no one really likes. He's the, you know, police chief in Die Hard who's showing up to say things that go against what the lead character wants to do.
Yeah. It's actually a tough role for an actor as well, because you kind of, you don't empathize with that person. You know.
Yeah, and do you feel like, in many ways, he is the next Sarek?
The quintessential sort of Vulcan?
Yeah, the representative of the species. And do you think that they were missing something that maybe they had with Sarek right from Journey to Babel?
Well, missing something, I guess maybe a stronger connection, like to another character, though, because he seems very aloof and distant from all the other characters. I mean, his best friend on planet Earth is like Admiral Forrest, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think there needed to be, it would have been more interesting if maybe Sovaal was somebody who did have a deeper connection to Archer than Archer referring to him as Ambassador Pointy.
Right.
You know, like that was, because they do have a history that goes back like 30 years, which I think is interesting.
I would have loved it too if we just kind of found out that like him and Forrest were like really good buddies.
Yeah.
And like, you know, we had a scene where like Archer is just complaining about Sovaal to Forrest about how he's so uptight. And like Forrest is something like, that's what he wants you to think. Like something like that. Just like an offhand kind of joke where we get the sense that, because we know from the, you know, series going onwards, humans have really great friendships with Vulcans.
Yeah.
And so it's not out of the norm to imagine that Forrest might have a friendship with Sovaal. Like they might have some sort of, you know, cordial relationship.
Well, I think, okay, let's pick up the Sovaal conversation in just a minute or two. Because let's start with some of the ones that really get into Vulcan culture. I think the first one up is fusion, where again we find, you know, Vulcans that are happy to experiment with their emotions.
I
will use the word problematic. This is a problematic episode in which it's kind of a metaphor for sexual assaults, and with one T'Pol being forced to have a mind meld on her, and we have this very creepy Vulcan guy like who's using telepathic sort of trickery on her in her dreams.
Yeah.
It's unsettling, but I pay more attention to maybe the Vulcan captain, the Vulcan engineer, where we understand where they're coming from.
Right.
And I think that it is interesting that, okay, Vulcans can embrace their emotions and they still seem to be functional human beings as well.
Right.
I think that's a very interesting thing.
Yeah. Like, I like the idea that Vulcans are able to live a different way if they feel drawn in that way. Like, you want to believe that there could be diversity in Vulcan society. And I like the idea that maybe there are some emotional Vulcans out there that aren't creepers, like the, you know, the main antagonist of this episode. And so, yeah, I do like those characters.
And also, they do establish, because Trip is very inquisitive, you know, he's like, Vulcans, yes, they have sex, and Vulcans, they dance.
Yeah,
I was just like, okay, yeah, I'd love to watch this, one of these Vulcan ceremonial dances that was being discussed. Do we see something like that in Amok Time when they are coming out into that kind of arena?
No, they're marching out playing the instruments, but they're not dancing.
Yeah.
How have we not seen Vulcan dancing in like 50 years of Star Trek?
Discovery is still in the air.
Yeah.
There's a chance, man.
It could always happen.
I can picture it going. Like, if we get that Pike spinoff, I'm sure there's got to be like a Spock does the Watusi.
Sure.
I was about to say Batusi, but I meant Watusi.
Right.
So, yeah, there you go.
I'm down for it.
We do have a follow up to that one with Stigma, which again, I think the writer's hearts were in the right place.
That's the thing.
In
it's
this
like,
one.
I feel like when this episode's written, they're probably like, feeling kind of daring doing an episode like this. It doesn't age well.
It's a very heavy-handed metaphor for LGBTQ community and HIV.
Yeah.
And it's like you kind of watch it with like your face kind of in your palms half the time because it's just like, oh, guys, this is just really, really on the nose and probably a little bit insensitive with regards to some of their handling of it. But I know what they're trying to do and that their heart's in the right place here. But essentially, Stigma is following, you know, kind of, and it is established prior that not all Vulcans have the capacity for mind meld. And I wonder if that's actually true or if Vulcan society is so against mind melding that they don't want people to believe that all Vulcans have the capacity for mind melding.
That's the way I read it.
Yeah. But essentially what we're finding out here is that because of that assault that T'Pol had from a few seasons earlier, she's contracted this neurological disease.
Mm-hmm.
And can she get a cure? Can they? Can Phlox get research for this? If the Vulcans would allow it, yes, but guess what? They won't because they see her as a minority of people engaging in the mind melds. And I do like the fact that there is a quote-unquote member of the minority on this planet that wants, you know, Vulcans to not be so monolithic. And he is saying, like, I will help you as best as I can, you know, but ultimately, he's kind of unsuccessful here, like, because Phlox isn't ultimately able to get the research that he needs. And this is something that's going to stick with T'Pol for at least, what, another season?
Yeah. And T'Pol is a really interesting character, because when we first meet her in Broken Bow, she very much represents the same thing as, like, Soval does. Like, she is that very, you know, as presented on the show, very kind of stiff and kind of stern Vulcan who's looking down on humanity. And we see that she's a character who's often betrayed by her own society throughout the series, obviously in Stigma, but even over the Andorian stuff where they're listening in and basically then they're pissed off at her for leading Archer to uncover the truth and pass on the
Shadows
evidence.
Shadows of Pajem.
Yeah. And so she's often someone who wants to represent her species to the best of her ability and does so on the show, but her own species will often throw her under the bus.
Yeah. It is interesting that, you know, looking at an episode like Shadows of Pajem, where the Vulcans can be established as deceptive as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We're always been told, like, Vulcans cannot lie.
Right.
You know? So it is interesting that there is, as you say, Cam, further cracks in this, but there's hypocrisy within Vulcan society.
Right.
And I think Enterprise wants to dig into that when we get to season four, which it's kind of I think this is the ultimate Vulcan story that we're told here with a three-parter with the Forge, Awakening, and Kishara. I don't know. How have you come around on this three-parter? I know when you said you watched it initially, you kind of not all that interested in Vulcan politics, where I was just riveted by everything going on.
The first time through, I enjoyed it. It was just that more that coming off of, I really loved the Augments arc. And so I was like, holy smokes, that was great. And then this one was kind of like, oh, well, this wasn't as exciting as the Augments arc, but going back and rewatching it for this episode, it was really interesting to watch it in isolation, and that it really did suck me in a lot more. It wasn't kind of coming off of like a really energetic, you know, episode and then bouncing into this thing, into this story. I do still find some of it kind of dorky, you know, anything with like Archer doing Indiana Jones stuff. Is a little goofy.
Okay.
And finding the most brand new looking relic of all time.
Hey, those Vulcans keep things,
they do.
You know, different minerals on that planet. Who knows?
And I do have a bit of a problem with, I feel like him having the Katra pass to Archer is something that I'm not crazy about.
So we're talking about Surok's Katra.
Yeah.
So we did have allusions to Surok in, Fusion as well, because they had that mini statue there. So they are still establishing that Surok is kind of a notable figure here within Vulcan society at this point in time. But essentially what this is getting at is the Sirenites.
The followers of Surok, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're all followers of Surok, but the Sirenites are saying that, you know, Surok's teachings have been warped over, you know, the last 1800 years.
Right.
And I think if they can get this artifact, they'll actually have proof of that and you'll get the original text. I think it's kind of interesting with regards to maybe religious allusions that
totally.
you could pick up on in today's society. Yeah, so look, this is kind of interesting to see how maybe Vulcan society got taken on the wrong course and how the Cyrenites are actually closer to the ones that we know from the 23rd, 24th century onwards. Like they T'Pol is once again featured in this, and she is seen as kind of a guiding force to bring Vulcans as we know them from our viewings of TNG, etc.
Right, yeah, and yeah, like, I feel like she should have been the carrier of the Katra in this story. Like, does it bother you that it's Archer?
No, not at all.
No? I don't know.
He's the main character.
He is, but I feel...
And the Serac wanted him to have it as well.
I know.
To me, it's like we would not have gotten those scenes where we're literally on Vulcan 1800 years ago, and we're watching, like, nukes go off. And
right.
They also just established really interesting things here where it took, you know, 1800 years for Vulcans to unite and reach the stars. Whereas they point out that maybe they are wondering how fast humans are able to do it if it took humans just 100 years to do that. So I think they're establishing a lot of kind of the motivations behind the paternalism that's going on within the Vulcan-human relations here right now. And also, it's very great in that it's establishing that there is kind of a Romulan agent running the entire planet with Vlas, the administrator.
Yeah, so. Vlas, played by the guy who played Admiral Layton.
Yeah, Robert Foxworthy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
There you go. So, to me, this is just... We find out more about Vulcan culture in this three-parter than I think we did with all the other episodes combined, because it's literally like... three episodes in a row that take place on Vulcan.
Yeah, and there's a couple elements I want to touch on. One, I loved the intro in The Forge, the first part, where Saval is talking about his fears about humans. Like, I felt like that section was really well written, and you really got a sense of why that character was, you know, could be perceived as uptight in the earlier seasons. Like, it felt like they were finally addressing a character that maybe they recognized had some problems in terms of getting an audience to be interested in that character's ongoing journey and giving him dialogue that really underscores why he's a great character.
Well, we even have him and Trip talking, and, you know, Saval says, I've been on Earth 30 years. Of course I'm going to have some affection for it. Trip's like, well, you hide it. He's like, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I love that little exchange, and it really gives, you know, Saval, that exchange might give Saval so much more depth right there than he had, like, in the prior three seasons.
Yeah, and also the whole section where he gets kidnapped by Shran and is being tortured because Shran doesn't believe that the Vulcans are going to launch an offensive against the Andorians. And he's, you know, has this torture device that goes up higher levels, and Saval says, turn it up to the highest and let's just get this over with, basically. Like, you can tell that this character has gone a long way. Like, it feels like the writers took a long time to get their grasp on what makes him interesting, but it felt like they were there by season four for sure, but it feels like this three-part episode really showcases it.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on this trilogy here?
Yeah, I thought the introduction of T'Pau into this story was very interesting to see as well. A younger version of a character who obviously has a lot of, pretty significant legacy on TOS. And to see her as someone who's going to play a prominent role in Vulcan society going forward. So I was very interested in seeing that.
Yeah. So as we wrap up Enterprise, I mean, they do establish that the Vulcans, humans, Andorians, Tellarites, Rigelians, they all come together in the end to form the Federation. I do think that this is kind of a good origin story for the Vulcans as we get to know them in the centuries to come as well.
And just the friendship with the humans, like more of that bond being forged throughout those four seasons as well. The other thing is actually T'Pol coming over to Starfleet. I think that's very noteworthy too in season four.
Yeah. It still kind of rubs me the wrong way that they couldn't just give her a jumpsuit. She still had to wear a cat suit.
Yeah.
I was like, I mean, she got that great, you know, insignia on her arm and she got the pips. I'm like, give her the uniform, guys. It's just kind of like, come on, you know.
Speaking of T'Pol, you know, we talked about how this three-part story, you know, in season four, the Vulcan arc, brought a lot to, in terms of representing Vulcans on Star Trek. Do you think T'Pol did a good job of increasing our knowledge of Vulcan society?
You asked me a question a couple of weeks ago that's been sticking to my head, and is T'Pol your favorite character? And I never really thought about my favorite character on Enterprise, I think it's probably easy to point to Trip or Archer as, you know, like likable dudes and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I realized, like, as I, if you asked me in the first two seasons of Enterprise, no, T'Pol would not have been my favorite character. But I think by the time we got to the end of it, they gave her so many great things to do.
Yeah.
She had so many hills and valleys, whether it's her mother relationship, it's Koss, her husband. It's the
Koss, pretty decent guy.
Pretty decent dude. Yeah. He's logical.
Yeah.
Right? You know?
Yeah.
And her relationship with Trip as well. Like, this is a Vulcan who has so much to do, so many journeys throughout this. I really, really think that T'Pol did good with the Vulcans here. Like, and I would not have necessarily said that in the first two seasons. And I lay that up mostly on the writers giving her stuff to do, like we see in Fusion, where, again, it's kind of that sexual assault metaphor that it's very heavy-handed. And
Yeah. I do really appreciate that they seem like they looked at Spock a lot in terms of this character, in finding ways to bring conflict into that character. So you really did feel like you got a character journey. It was not a fairly static Vulcan character throughout the series, which is something I think maybe Tuvok fell victim to in terms of the writing.
Yeah.
Of just like, okay, write the Vulcan responses to this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas it did feel like they found good ways, and we can argue about whether some of them worked dramatically well or not, but they always were trying to find ways to basically pull T'Pol out of her comfort zone, or to put a little bit of conflict into that character so that we understood her growth and why her perceptions of humanity and her mission and all that changed throughout those four seasons. Like, it feels like her journey really delivers when you get to the end of that series.
And even think about, like, just thrusting her into a situation like the Delphic Expanse, where, you know, like, it's much more difficult in this part of space for her to control those emotions. And I don't know. Great journey for T'Pol there.
And also, evolution of the Vulcans, Vulcan neuropressure.
Boom. I was wondering for years why you kept trying to do this to me. And I was like, and then I finally watched season three of Enterprise, and I was like, oh, yeah, now I understand.
I like to think Gary Graham was like, where's my scene of doing this?
Okay. So I guess we go back to Sarek once again with Star Trek Discovery. And I think it's kind of a fascinating thing where, look, in Battle of the Binary Stars, we get that flashback and we're meeting like a younger Burnham. She's all dressed up like in her, that Vulcan regalia.
Yeah.
You go to an episode like Lethe and you really understand that Vulcan society looks at Sarek as kind of a weirdo. Like,
oh, yeah.
He's this guy who has, like, this obsession with humanity. He's marrying a human woman. Mm-hmm. He has a half-Vulcan son.
Yeah.
He's adopting a human and raising her like you would raise a Vulcan.
But he's still very, like, stiff and, like, not giving any sort of cracks in his demeanor. It's really that's why Sarek, we've talked about him in the past, he's a fascinating character.
Oh, yeah.
Because nothing about him makes any sense.
No, but you can tell that their patience, like Vulcan authorities' patience, growing thin with Sarek, though.
Yeah.
They're just, like, looking at this guy like, okay.
It's funny because you look at Sarek often on the outside as, like, something of a stereotypical Vulcan type. And yet he is kind of a rebel from society.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's like, it really makes me wonder how much of this rebellious spirit is alive in Vulcans throughout all these series. You get a lot of them that are very traditional, but there has to be a lot of Sareks around.
Well, just look at his son.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, there's that rebellious spirit carries on.
Yeah.
And it bites Sarek in the butt, too.
Yeah, you know, because Spock choosing Starfleet. Yeah.
Like, their own relationship is very on the fence at times.
Oh, yeah. Does it surprise you, though, that Sarek is so hard on Spock, given his own rebellious nature?
Yeah, it does surprise me a little bit. Yeah. Do Vulcans not always see the contradictory nature of their own selves? Like, that's what I wonder.
Yeah.
I wonder how self-aware they are.
It's very hard to say. We haven't gotten a lot that would really sell you that they are aware of it.
Yeah. So moving forward with just Vulcans in general, look, as I said, CBS, everybody's getting a spinoff at this point.
Yeah.
Where do you think more Vulcan stories are going to be told, though? Because, look, we've got Discovery, it's blasting off to like the 31st century, whatever.
Yeah.
Vulcans are likely going to be in a very different place. We also have Star Trek Picard. I wonder if that unification thread will be carried on to a certain degree.
There's also the question of if a Pike spinoff happens.
Yeah.
Because we got some really interesting stuff with Spock in Discovery Season 2.
Yeah.
And so it does open the door. And, you know, we did have those logic extremists in Lethe that were never really paid off that much. You know,
like, I'm fine with that.
I'm fine with it. But there are elements that we could explore further if they decided to continue in some way in that timeline with, you know, a Pike story or whatever. And if you've got Spock there, you know, that's a good avenue to get into those types of stories.
Yeah. I'll pitch this. I don't know. Look, maybe Star Trek Lower Decks is where you can have a lot more fun with the Vulcans, though.
Right.
The new animated series. And I think fun Vulcans are probably the best Vulcans that we get to mess around with. So I really, really do wonder what they decide to do with the Vulcans in the animated series that's going to come out next year.
Yeah. I was reading some behind the scenes. I can't remember what it was tied to. I think it might have been one of the movies or something where they considered having the Vulcans leaving the Federation briefly. And I wonder if that's something I would ever want to see. I don't think so. Like, I like the idea of the Vulcans being very tied to humanity.
Yeah.
You know, they were the ones that basically brought us out of our shell and into the galaxy. I don't like the idea of them just, like, going rogue.
The other thing that you kind of come to understand as you watch Star Trek Enterprise, though, is, you know, Vulcans' best allies are, in fact, the humans.
Yeah.
You know, they have no stronger allies in the galaxy than humans. So
Why do you think that is?
You could argue maybe it's the paternalistic nature of it. But, okay, yeah, Saval has a good line, and you're discussing that earlier, but he was saying, like, humans, I don't understand them. Sometimes they have the arrogant nature of the Andorians.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're as, you know, weird as the Tellarites. Then you'll go and be as logical as Vulcans. Like, we cannot pin you guys down, you know? And I wonder if they're kind of drawn to that to a certain degree. There's no pinning them down. So what can they do to get involved there?
Well, we know from Tuvok's puzzles that Vulcans are really into these sorts of problem solving.
Sure.
Isn't it like humans are like the ultimate puzzle that they just want to figure out?
Yeah. Well, like, we even see from Sarek, finds them fascinating. Vulcans find humans fascinating. So I can understand that.
Yeah. It's a journey I look forward to seeing more of. And, you know, when we look at Voyager, when we look at DS9, they often shuffled the Vulcans off to the side. So I am very curious how much future Star Trek chooses to focus on the Vulcans versus saying, well, we've kind of done the Vulcans to death. Let's focus on, you know, fill in the blank for whatever species is not that well developed.
Yeah. That's why I think Lower Decks probably has the best shot at doing something interesting there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, unless we get something out of that Picard spinoff with a reunification story, I think we might see something there. And that could be really cool.
All right.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Yeah, we're accelerating our plans for the Star Trek Enterprise reviews, and we'll be tackling space Nazis with Stormfront Parts 1 and 2, Cam.
Yep.
Yeah. Look, if you did not like this episode, don't worry. We're going to make fun of it nonstop.
Yeah.
So this will probably be more entertaining than an episode you love, because we can't really make fun of episodes you love that much.
I do hope, though, because I've only seen it the once. I do hope when I go back, there are kernels of things that I appreciate.
Sure.
That's all I'm hoping for.
Sure. Look, no, I know off the bat the... well, no, I guess I can't name anything, but tune in next week.
It's a really good makeup.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. You can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam. V is in Vloss in bed with the Romulans. Oh, my. Smith.
You can find me at Reporton. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N is in Nero pressure applied by Vulcans. Oh, my.
Okay. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.